Great. All right. Thank you. So, Tuesday, October 14th, 2025. There's still a few people showing up. Lovely to be here to see everybody. Appreciate people showing up. I mean, it's funny to say that as if you came here to make me feel good. Anyway, feels like a lot's going on, and yet, nothing really. But I'm working on a project, some writing, and I wound up going back to this book called Trauma Sensitive Mindfulness, which I've looked at and never quite got into, but yesterday I was getting into it a bit, and think it's useful to apply some of some of these ideas of kind of basically how we manage our energy when we're meditating. So this is maybe, I'm talking about it now because we're going to meditate, and so just to put out some ideas. And it's not even so much that's in that book, but what it got me thinking about about my own practice and how I teach and how I think about meditation. And I talk so much in this context about energy. And I think that trauma expresses itself as energy. That's one way of characterizing it. And so working with energy in meditation is really key, and so that means raising energy and calming energies. So we're trying to find a middle place, right? The middle way and equanimity, the balance. Sometimes we need more energy when there's a dullness, and then sometimes we need less energy when there's too much stimulation. And so just that's why I focus when I talk about posture, because posture has a big impact on how energy is moving in the body. When you slump, which I tend to do, it tends to suppress the energy. When you sit up more upright, it tends to release and open up energy. And then another thing to point out is that although we typically meditate with our eyes closed, opening your eyes can be a way to break out of more mental states or emotional states, where when you are feeling in some way sort of claustrophobic or trapped a little bit in your head, that you can just open your eyes. And that's a really good break to kind of step out of any kind of a negative inner cycle. And then finally, using the breath for both calming and energizing. I think it's pretty clear how that works. We can talk about it further if you want later. So let's settle in and begin the period of meditation. This will be about 20 minutes. And I'll give some guidance as usual, and then I'll allow some quiet time. Oh, yeah, just settling into a posture that feels supportive and appropriate for you right now. You can lie down for meditation. Our classic posture is upright. You can also stand or walk for meditation. People don't usually do that on Zoom. Certainly welcome to. And closing your eyes if you're comfortable with that. It's also fine to just lower the gaze so that you're not staring at the screen. It's the first thing is to get away from that. visual of looking at the computer screen or phone screen. But then turning inward with your awareness and beginning by feeling your inner world as best you can in this moment. And while you don't have to name how you feel, it is helpful to just be present with whatever feelings are here. Those may be more physical, they may be more emotional, maybe energetic. And really, they're most likely to be a combination of those things. So we don't have to name all this, just feel what you're feeling. And doing that, though, with a sense of openness, not trying to catch or trap your feelings, not bringing too much aversion to them, but just feeling that whatever is going on is a flow. It's not solid. So whether it's pleasant or unpleasant or neutral, there doesn't have to be any effort to control or suppress or express. Feelings that are arising, just allow. If there's a feeling of stuckness or closed feeling, to maybe take a deeper breath and open the chest, softening the belly. This helps to release stuck energies. And this coincides with the more upright posture. If, on the other hand, there's a feeling of overwhelm, of too much energy, can soften, let the shoulders release, soften the belly. Lengthen the exhalation and have a sense of energy moving downward into the earth. There isn't one way to work with energies and feelings. Requires us to be attentive and to experiment. Of course, this is going to begin with a more sensitive perception of what we are experiencing. Really asking you to be very present with these feeling states. Then respond wisely, intuitively, to what's present. Mindfulness of breathing itself connects us with the sense of flow because the breath is flowing. So as we feel that aspect of experience, it's a natural next step to connect with the flow of energies and feelings in the body, in the nervous system. And it's very common and normal that our effort to be present for these nonverbal experiences is interrupted by thought, by verbal experiences, mental formations. And these thoughts often arise out of the feeling realm or are triggered by the feeling realm. We can acknowledge that thoughts are here, and even in just a flash, often see how they're connected to the feeling realm, the feelings that are appearing. And then just gently come back to the body, to the breath, to that inner flow. Right. Well, I kind of initiated a topic there. And then as we were sitting, I was like, I don't know if I want to talk about this anymore. it's sort of what's on my mind, so I don't have anything else to pull out right now. I've had conflicting feelings about the I'll say popularization of the idea of trauma as a underlying cause of addiction and of something that interferes significantly with people's meditation. And it's not that I don't think that's true to some degree, but more I get concerned with the kind of what seems like is pervasive use of a term like that. And it seems like it becomes almost like a trendy thing. It's like everything is trauma or everything is, whatever, your inner child or whatever the different, over my years of recovery, as well as Dharma practice, I see these sort of different things become popular as sort of, the Well, I think you're getting the idea, but that this is like the key thing. We found the key, and looking at this book, Trauma Centered Mindfulness, which is a very very thoughtful and very important book. One of the things it says is like 90% of people experience trauma. So I think, well, then it's not an abnormality. It's more like dukkha, which is like everybody has it. So then because I think the problem for me is when we sort of pathologize these things that are just human experiences. I mean, the human condition is one that is inherently difficult and painful. And so it seems to me that dukkha and trauma become like synonyms. And the Buddha says that, birth is dukkha, aging is dukkha, death is dukkha. Well, you could say the same about that those are all traumatic experiences. And then, not having what we want, having what we don't want. In short, in brief, the five aggregates of clinging are dukkha, the five aggregates of clinging are trauma. So, I at the end of the day, my feeling is, well, it's the same problem, and so it's helpful to understand some of the details of dukkha and understand some of the tools for working with it, but I think that we risk actually feeding it, making dukkha and trauma worse, more problematic when we pathologize them and start to try to figure them out and judge them and consider them bad or things that shouldn't happen or there's something wrong with me. Now, this I am. If to be very clear, I am talking about ordinary dukkha and therefore ordinary trauma. I am not talking about what would traditionally be called trauma, which is like violence, rape, really agonizing physical and mental and emotional experiences, abuse, being abused as a child, or as an adult. And so I really want to be clear about that. I do not mean to trivialize those, that, and that's where I struggle with this. That's kind of where I get frustrated with this over what I feel. And you guys can respond, and I'd be happy to hear other people's take on this. But the feeling that a term gets overused to the point where, like, everybody experiences trauma, it to me diminishes the more serious circumstances that people experience that really require something that are not just dukkha. They are like, no, this is a thing that's like really requires a lot of special care and attention. So, this is what I battle with this that, and so I'm glad I kind of arrived at that point, that that's really my objection to the pervasive use of, 90% of people experience trauma. I don't think that's, I feel that diminishes the experience of people who have severe experiences that are deeply damaging and painful. Anyway, so there you go. What's interesting, though, coming back to like kind of where I started, and what interests me about this is that, and the reason I pulled out that book is because I'm trying to find, references to the kind of, it's a challenging mental states. That I put them between, they're not extreme, and they're not just ordinary. They're challenging experiences that aren't necessarily rooted in, because when we talk about trauma, we're usually talking about some event or events that had this impact. And there's the I'm more interested right now in terms of what I'm looking at with things that don't have obvious causes, that, it's the ways that we suffer that seem to be almost created by ourselves, but that's not even fair, because that sort of creates a judgment, but rather things that seem to just manifest out of our ordinary lives that become really painful. So I'm talking about, especially about depression, and that's what I'm working on writing about. The editor that I've worked with at Shambhala had kind of asked me to pursue that as a topic after several conversations and some things I had sent him. And so, it's one thing. I like, a lot of my writing is about my own experience, but, I want to have a broader view than that. And reading about the trauma-sensitive mindfulness is kind of like, well, how does he suggest, David Treleaven, how does he suggest working with these painful states? And it's very subtle stuff. It's stuff that I already mostly am doing, and working with. But so I don't know that I'm learning a lot, but I'm actually feeling really uncomfortable right now talking, so if it's not obvious. I do this because I talk about things that are uncomfortable because that's like what I'm interested in. And so it's just coming back to, again, this sort of ongoing theme about working with energies, that I think it's just so interesting, is And it ties into what I'm talking about, which is that when we give name to something, be it trauma, depression, anxiety, some condition, let's say, some state, when we give it a name, in Buddhist terms, that's perception. And you guys, a lot of you have heard me talking about this kind of nexus between feeling and perception. So, but when we give it a name, we reify it. We make it into something real, which in Buddhist terms, we could also say we are making it a self. So that instead of something just being an energetic, meaning a flowing experience, it becomes a thing, an object. And that's what I mean by a self. And this is one of the things we don't talk about, and I haven't heard a lot of Buddhist teachers talk about this. I've probably heard it, but I don't remember any Buddhist teacher saying it, that not only we, it's not just that humans have selves, but we make all everything around us into a self. And what I mean by that is that we make things into objects that have some self-existence, that it just, it's a thing that exists in and of itself, separate from the rest of the world, and in a static state, which is sort of redundant, but it's an important point because it's kind of key that the idea of self in Buddhism is that it is something static. It's something that's unchanging. And so, I was raised Catholic and I was taught that I had a soul. So there wasn't, nobody said that my body was going to live forever, but they said that my soul was going to live forever, that it was a permanent thing that went along with me. And this is when the Buddhist term anatta or anatta basically means no soul. That the Buddha said, I don't see a soul. I see a body, mind objects, I see consciousness, whatever, but I don't see anything that's just solid. And so when we name a state, we're making a thing, which then we have a rela it's classic duality, right? If there's a thing, then there's two things. There's my relationship to the thing, and there's the thing. And that relationship to the thing is problematic when the thing is something that's wrong with me. Right? Like, I have depression. I have trauma. So, and now I'm in this unresolvable place, which is that there's something wrong with me that I want to be different, but how do I change me? How do I change the thing that's me, that, and so what happens, we all do this. What we do is we try to change it with our minds. First of all, I'm going to fix how I feel by thinking my way out of it, right? Which is kind of therapy. And that has a value. There's a value in processing it. But at the end of the day, it winds up with this, as I often talk about, this feedback loop between I have this thing that I don't like, I'm trying to fix it, meaning I don't like it. So that creates a painful feeling. When I think about this thing that I don't like about myself, I feel bad about myself having this thing that I don't like about myself, which is the feedback loop. The more I think about it, the more I feel, the more I feel, the more I think about it. Feelings trigger thoughts. In case you haven't noticed, where do you think your thoughts come from? Notice that when you're meditating. Where did this, why did this thought pop into my head right now? Don't try to like figure it out. Just feel the feeling that was there as that thought arose, and you'll know, oh, it came out of that feeling. I mean, I'm oversimplifying, but so. This is why so often I point to just stop at feeling. and just, or, dial back to feeling, because usually it's not that I don't have thoughts. It's that I realize, oh, I'm having these thoughts. I need to turn toward the feeling because the feeling is feeding the thoughts. And the advantage of feeling, first of all, it's nonverbal, so it doesn't have a thought involved in it. And feeling is inherently energetic, and energy is constantly moving. And so when you turn toward feeling, what you feel is movement. And so you don't feel stuck. You feel flow. It may be unpleasant. It may be uncomfortable for the moment, but it's not a thing. You can feel that it's not a thing. So this is the practice of practicing with feeling is you're practicing with energy rather than practicing with a thing. And when we notice that we're having a thought, the thought is experienced as a thing. This thing arose in my mind. And now I have a relationship to that. I like it or I don't like it. I want to get rid of it or I want to think some more about it. But it's inherently self-feeding. That's how thoughts are, right? Thoughts, one thought leads to another. That's how I write books, by the way. I write down one thought and then I go, oh, what comes next? Oh, this. So it's easy because thoughts just never stop, That's why writing books is so easy. But not writing books, that's hard. Just breathing with energy. And the thing that is many of these feelings are somewhat unpleasant. Some of them are quite unpleasant. And so it's understandable that we quickly want to go into what humans think is their go-to control of the world, which is I'm going to think it out. I'm going to think myself out of it. That's our habitual way of interacting with the world is to figure it out. But the amazing thing about mindfulness, again, this is kind of preaching to the choir here, is that when you breathe with an experience, when you're mindful of an experience, first of all, it changes the experience, right? This is Heidegger's cat or whatever it is. It's, a principle of physics and philosophy that, and so, but we don't have to go there. Just all we have to do is feel it and see, oh, I'm trying to get away from this feeling. Wait, let me just stop. It's not a monster that's chasing me. It's something that I don't want to feel, but I'll be okay if I turn and feel it. And then we turn and feel and we go, oh, it's not that bad. It's unpleasant. Let me breathe. Oh, what? And I see it's changing. So if it's constantly changing, then it's not going to, it's not like an unresolvable problem. It's gonna resolve itself at some point by going away. Or when I, it turns out that applying mindfulness and with the breath, and the breath is an energetic process, is like the breath is then responding to the energetic quality of feeling. It's interacting with that and either calming or arousing feeling with the breath. And then we have the two arrows come in here, which is that when I'm not afraid of the feeling, when I'm not fighting with the feeling, there's just the feeling. There isn't the additional conflict with the feeling. And that in itself reduces the difficult problem. So now there's just a feeling, and with mindfulness and just being with it, non-reactivity, this now has become manageable. And now, because I'm not trying to fix it, I can respond to it. I'm not reacting to it with desire or aversion. I'm looking at it and saying, and having a relationship with it, saying, oh, what's going on here? And what would be a wise way to respond to an experience like this? And that might be call a friend, work out, take a nap, eat breakfast. I'm just talking about life, right? Just continue on and take care of yourself. Be kind to yourself. Meditate some more, meditate less, if it's not really working. So when we get to this place of non-conflict with our feelings, then we're much more capable of coming up with solutions that are not going to exacerbate the problem in and of itself. So it's so interesting. Somebody was talking to me, or I was hearing someone talk about teaching on Zoom and thinking nobody was listening because their heads were all down, and then realizing that people weren't making notes. And I was realizing that was happening this morning. So that's cute. I mean, I hope that you got something good. So thank you for your attention. At least I got myself worked up enough to shift my energy. And we have some time left for any comments. Devin, go ahead.
Hi everyone. Thank you, Kevin, for giving the meditation and the talk. It's still crazy to me that I can go to this meeting and you're the author of a book. Like, I guess I have some work to do, right? I'm putting you on a pedestal or something still.
Just
But
send
it
money.
does,
It's okay.
yeah.
Just send money. It's fine.
Right? Oh no, it still feels surreal, and I'm about 3.5 years sober, so I've been coming to this one for a while now when I can get a little break in the workday. But I really liked what you said about trauma. I think millennials or Gen Z, I've heard them say like lowercase t trauma and then uppercase t trauma to kind of distinguish the two. I'm not sure that does anything.
I mean, I get
maybe
it. Yeah.
yeah. But yeah, I liked what you said about that, and I liked what you were saying about energy. I think right now, like maybe an uppercase trauma had that happened in my family was my sister had a really late stage miscarriage recently. And so this morning we had the like cremation service, and that was really hard just to see like a really small box there. And go through all of that. But I think I struggle with at this point in my recovery, like if that's not a body and that's not a form, like what is it? You know, like okay, maybe it's just the energy that was there. So, you know, maybe I made the message what I wanted to hear today, but I do think that it's easier for me to accept that it maybe it was like energy and then it wasn't, and like that's okay, that maybe that's what it was. I'm not sure if you have any more thoughts on how to make meaning out of like no self, or make, you know, it's easy to say, well, then what matters? So yeah, I'm not sure if it makes sense, but it's kind of where I'm at.
Thanks, Devin. And first of all, yeah, I'm really sorry for that loss. It's very painful. And
Thank you.
I don't think, I think what's important to me about something like that is to just acknowledge that there's real grief and loss, and it's sad and tragic, and also just real, and life unfolding in the way it does. I mean, and so, there's those two pictures of like, this is real, this is our family. This is this person I love having this great loss, and you've lost something as well. And being kind around that, not, certainly not trying to diminish it. But I don't think you have to figure it out either. You know, trying to find like meaning or what is that? It's just you're recognizing like, wow, like it's a mystery. I mean, you know, I guess for lack of a better, you know, like life and death. And I mean, it's not like we're going to like figure out why things happen. I mean, think, you know, there's causality. It's just, you know, the bodies, but trying to look for, I mean, that's where, you know, I don't believe in God, so I don't have to like have this question of like, why would God do this? It's like, no, it's just human bodies, and you know, there's that reality that you accept. You know, I mean, the Dharma picture is, you know, that these bodies are fragile and they don't always work properly, and you know, that brings about these what are really painful losses. But there's nothing like out of, you know, out of whack about the universe. It's just kind of how the universe works. The universe doesn't really care about us as individuals in some way, you know. So I mean, I kind of hold those two, if I'm making clear what I'm saying, or the two. One is the big picture that it's just life, and the other is it's real. And it needs to be held with care and approached with care and love, and taken with great sensitivity. But I don't, you know. And then when you're thrown into that in between place of like, yeah, but what is this? You know, that's where it's kind of like, don't know, you know, just don't know, don't have a. You know what? You know, the fact that life exists at all is such a crazy miracle when you think, like, first there were rocks, and then there's like things crawling around. Like, how did that happen? But that's a whole other question. So, and I guess the last thing I wanted to say is, like, you know, when you said, I mean, this is what I was thinking about, like what you were thinking about when I'm talking. That's how Dharma talks work. They're not, we all hear, or everybody here got a different Dharma talk because you're processing it through your own experience. And that's, to me, exactly what you should do. Like, not to like, well, what's Kevin trying? No, I don't, who cares what I want to talk about? What matters is what's landing for you, and what's it bringing up for you, and what's it revealing for you. So that's great. So I appreciate you being here and taking care of yourself to show up. And Joni, hello.
Hi, Kevin.
Hi.
I love that you brought this up because having been a deeply traumatized person, it is really kind of difficult when everybody says, "Oh, I had trauma as a child, and that's why I use," and that may very well be. But if everyone is saying that, it really trivializes the people who've suffered deep, repeated trauma. And it all depends on, how old were you? What tools did you have? Who did you have to support you? All kinds of things come in to mind. But ultimately, I think for myself, allowing feelings, whatever they are, to be, and you don't need to examine them really deeply. Because it does answer questions to get therapy and to go into some deep questioning. But ultimately, knowing that you're okay right now and it was horrible and it's over is really the mindfulness that works for me. And even though I will always have triggers, no doubt, I'm not going to just tell myself that's true. You're always going to have triggers, but it is what it is. And I love the capital T and lower T. I think that was really, Devin, thank you, because there is a matter, there is a sense of trivializing things when we all have the same problem, and we don't. I mean, I'm not, lucky us, America. We don't have bombs dropping on our heads right now. There's just what is trauma, I think, is the question. I mean, bad things happen. It's part of life, like you said, but real trauma is different. So I don't know. If you wanted to talk to me more about this with your book, hey, I have a load of information for you if you'd like to know.
Thank you.
But thank you, trauma. Thank you
Well,
very much for this trauma talk. I appreciate it.
we can talk next week. Something came up as you were talking, just that no, it's not coming back. I saw some other hands like go up and then come down. Oh, I see Robert's got his hand up. Go ahead.
Hey, Kevin.
Yeah.
Hey, everybody. Good talk. Thank you. I'm thinking about responsibility and karma in all of this. What, you know, do I go to, I sometimes I'll go to a place and look at tragedy and trauma in my life, but then knowing about karma, the action, maybe I did an action that is causing the reaction of my karma in another life. Maybe I wasn't a nice guy.
Well, you can't know, and that's something the Buddha says is like it's not a fruitful exploration. Certainly, everything has causes, but to try to sort out why did this happen to me, that is the way of madness. You know, it just becomes you know, an endless search, and as you're really is coming, like what I'm hearing is like there's this potential then to turn it into judgment. It's like saying, you know, reason people are poor is because they were, you know, greedy in their past life or something, and then, you know, it just becomes it's not helpful, I don't think. I think that's the most important thing about karma is that you are creating it right now. And because you can't change anything from the past and you can't make it be the way you want it to be in the future. You can only act in a skillful and wholesome way in the present moment. And that's why we practice mindfulness, so that we can be more awake to what, I mean, it's one of the reasons, so that we can be more awake to what karma we are creating in this moment through our thoughts, through our words, through our actions. But to try to like figure out like why we're experiencing some particular thing is just there isn't anything that we get out of that. You're not responding.
Yeah, I've been on the wrong track, I guess. Wow. Okay.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, and I am not just speaking for myself. Like, I have heard very, and I am pretty much repeating the words of very skilled, like Buddhist monks. Like, Thanissaro Bhikkhu makes this particular point. I'm more or less paraphrasing what Thanissaro Bhikkhu says. So I'm not like pulling out like, well, this is what I think. This is pretty much the agreed upon understanding of karma. And literally the Buddha says in the suttas, if you try to go back and sort out your past karma to figure out why things are the way they are now, it will just make you crazy. And it's a very, but it's a very natural thing to want to do, because humans, you know, we're driven by questions. We're driven by wanting to understand things. That's how we've created the world we have, for good or for bad. It's why we have air conditioning and heaters, and toilets. But it also leads to another kind of spinning, and judging. So that's you really want to want. It's not that helpful to try to figure out why things are like this.
Okay.
All
Thank
right.
you.
Yeah,
Thanks
thanks,
for that.
Robert. All right. Well, we're officially out of time, so we'll let Jeff say something. Are you coming tonight, Jeff, to the monastery?
Well, if I live that long, perhaps.
How are your hips doing?
Very well, thank you. Thank you for asking.
Yeah.
I just wanted to share a little tiny bit of information. I have a friend who is a psychologist and associated with Kaiser Recovery Program, and she talks about trauma as being the body and mind, not that those are two different things, reaction to a quote traumatic event,
Right.
and that the major difficulty for everyone, but addicts and in particular, is not being able to let go of it at a level where it becomes less effectual.
Yeah.
And she further makes the point that although I love the capital T, lower T trauma, very important distinction, but everyone has lost a loved one or will. Everyone has failed at something they wish to succeed at. Everyone has had their heart broken in one way or another. These are all traumatic events, lower T certainly. But that the process that we have to go through is learning how to let go of these things. I think that the ninth step in a program that many of us are familiar with is an exercise in trying to let these things go. And it
Yeah.
can be very effective. And I'll see you tonight. Thanks.
Okay. Thanks, Jeff. Yeah. So for those in the Bay Area, I will be at the Berkeley Buddhist Monastery tonight at 7:30. That's 2304 McKinley in Berkeley. And for those who will not be there, is the virtual Buddhist Recovery Network conferences this weekend. So just go to BuddhistRecovery.org and you'll learn about that. And somehow I'm fitting in a dentist appointment and the No Kings rally all in one day. So I don't know how that's going to happen, but we'll see. And otherwise, I will see you next Tuesday. Peace. Stay safe. Thanks, everybody.
Thanks, Kevin. Bye,
All right.
everybody.
Thank you. Bye.
Thanks,
Oh, I've
Kevin.
got these floating hearts now. It's pretty cool.
Thanks, Gary.
Technology. All right, Mike. Take care, everybody.